It's nice to have just a few quiet breaths together. This is a very wonderful and occasion to be together in this way, and to for me personally to be here with very old friends and people whom I've lived with and trained with and pained with and cried with and many other things for a number of years, as I was considering, thinking about the weekend and the timing and everything. And I realized it was almost 30 years to, at least to the month, I think it was about April 1971 when I first traveled to Wat Bopong to meet Ajahn Chah for the first time. And as I was contemplating this and thinking about what kind of things I would like to speak about and offer, I was just flooded by and overwhelmed with the amount of things that have happened in the last 30 years, and then going back to when I first became a novice monk and heard of Ajahn Chah. And so it was so overwhelming, I had to kind of quit writing things down and just kind of sit quietly as we were just doing and just kind of be with my body, my breath, and the simplicity of the moment. And I think, well, this is one of the most wonderful things that I learned from a most wonderful man, was that ability in the kind of the midst of anxiety, anticipation, worry, fear, concern, to just step back for a moment and kind of be with and trust, if you will, the next moment. The next breath, the next footstep. When we hear about the teachings of somebody or the reputation or of someone we're interested, or a situation or a person that we're interested in, I think there's two kind of elements of that that draws us to something. And I think the first element is our own curiosity that usually is triggered by a friend, a reading, a rumor, whatever, like a reputation that we hear about somebody or something. So I can only assume that everyone here had this kind of curiosity, not so much maybe about Ajahn Chah. I'm assuming that most people here came initially because you were drawn to the Buddha's teachings, to this thing that we call Buddhism, you know, the Dharma, the Sangha. And so similarly, that then we hear about teachers, and there's so many teachers, like so many things in this country, there's an overwhelming amount of information and teachers and things to pick from. So I think one of the great, most painful things that we all have to live with in modern times, and I think most especially in this country, is to have so many incredible choices in our life. And I don't know what Ajahn Chah would say if he was still alive today about the kind of the chaos and the so-called age of communication that we live in. But I feel most certain that he would adapt and have something very simple and wise to offer from the way he lived and the way he taught. The things that really stand out, and a lot of these things have been mentioned already, and I guess I would like to reiterate, I think one of the most powerful things about his life is that he was really the living embodiment of these teachings and of what this golden kind of rather daunting image of the Buddha we see up here, that That's true. Some of us, it's a statue. To some of us, it's a religious, spiritual, inspiring kind of symbol. To some, it's maybe idolatry and this kind of idol worship, depending on kind of what kind of exposure we've had to Buddhism. But in a person like Ajahn Chah, we have this kind of living, breathing embodiment of these teachings. And one of the expressions I remember Ajahn Sumedho using is like breathing life into the teachings. And one of the things that I think he would do so well is to breathe this life into the teachings. And he didn't breathe it in by being something extraordinary or unusual or mysterious, but by being very human, by being very present, by being very available. And in that, one was put at ease in his presence. I was very blessed and fortunate to accompany him in 1979 on his second trip to the UK and his first trip to this country, and turned out to be his only trip to this country. And one of the monks, when I was going to leave, and I was quite excited about this trip and being honored to go with him, that and a bit concerned about what it would be like coming back to the West and visiting and being exposed to many things that I grew up with. And one of the things Ajahn Chah always used to say about us, that the Western monks, he said, well, I think most of you, if your hometown or village was as near as Bangkok, probably most of you would have left. And so I think there was something about having a fairly long journey between us and home, and a lot of other factors that helped us to stay. So anyway, this monk said to me, well, when you go on this journey, he says, you're not going to have a lot to worry about. He says, it's because it's kind of like taking the church with you. And I kind of thought about that, and I said, yeah, he's right. I just kind of like, it's almost like being kind of swept along in the wake of his energy, of his incredible charisma and love and compassion and kindness. There's so many kind of stories and anecdotes and experiences, and this is why I felt so overwhelmed. And one of the things that I think the most powerful teaching, and I think you'll find it with all of the monks and nuns of Ajahn Chah's tradition, and that have lived and been around him, or that have been, had these things passed on, was the way that he taught us to speak was really to not to plan and to try to make a lot of invest a lot of energy in preparation, which for most of us in our Western way of thinking and education is kind of hard to do, to get up and kind of entrust, if you will, in the spontaneity of the moment. So I was working very hard, because the last 5 years I've been working, I finished an undergraduate and now a graduate degree, and I fight it tooth and nail, and I don't do it, still don't do it very well, to go the other way. But the tendency for today was to kind of sit down and write a lot of things and plan a lot. So this morning I was up about 4:30. And I often wake up early. I guess it's kind of left over from the early risings from 20 years of monasticism. But so I was there, and I was sitting quietly in the stillness of the morning, cool and very pleasant. And I was just flooded with thoughts. Not like anxiety, but just so many things were coming. So many that it was, you know, it was like a fast stream flowing by me, and there's no way I could kind of stop this stream or try to capture really anything of it. And I just kind of settled back, and I said, I just have to kind of trust and go into this afternoon, and then tomorrow be talking more about his kind of final days and years, to trust more, because then it seems, or it feels, that it's then more appropriate, because they're talking about the level of receptivity and connectedness. As we all sit here, we're connected in so many ways. We're connected as human beings. We're connected because we sit and we breathe. We're connected because we're interested in making our lives better by understanding what it is to have been born, to get old, to have aches and pains and illness, and to ultimately have to die. And this is really the essence of his teaching, the essence of the Buddha's teachings, really pointing us to the facts of life. And it's kind of shocking. And on that trip, and as one of the story was related about the layperson that was very upset about his wife dying, and Ajahn Chah was laughing, and not laughing at him, but that this was not a sad occasion, but let's give this a bigger space. Let's not get so caught up. There's something bigger happening here. And so his encouragement, his example was always this kind of momentum that would be supported to get bigger in oneself, to give things more space. And I think if I were to describe what his teaching has been for me is just that, the ability to get bigger, to be able to embrace more, if you will. One of the things I remember is, and I don't remember when, but it was a very powerful thing that he would talk about, that most people kind of celebrate birth. They celebrate when there's a baby and everybody's kind of gooing and guying about around a baby, and babies are cute and they're helpless, and it brings out kind of the best in us, an infant, a kind of an innocence of the first inklings of our species, of a huge birth of a human being. But he would say, well, there's all this fuss and kind of celebration, and people should really be crying, because this is the beginning of a lot of pain and suffering. But then when people die, everybody is like grieving and sorrow, but they should be happy and celebrating, because, you know, the pain, at least as we can see it in a lifetime, is over. And so these are the kind of, you know, anecdotal and things that he would always point to and see things a little differently from the rest of the world. When we came to the UK and also to the States, there were themes, and I was looking back, I have my notebook from 1979 that I kept a diary. And I didn't write a lot of detail, but I kind of wrote where we were and kind of what was going on. And as I looked through it over the last week or so, there were kind of certain themes that came through. And one of the things that in this ability that you've heard from everybody that's spoken today is his incredible ability to be present with people, and it's like to be with people where they are. So it's like this, I almost feel it and sense it as like we think of a flowing river. And like the river, you know, adjusts and flows faster and slower according to, you know, what part of the river and how it winds and moves and eventually flows into the ocean. And he was very much like this adaptable kind of energy that would be present in any given situation, and through that presence be able then to offer quite spontaneously to speak to the needs of the people that were before him. And that was everything from just being with him alone by yourself to being with a group of people. It didn't really matter. It seemed to always, and it just seemed to be just perfect, just kind of on. It couldn't have been planned better to what he would give and what he would offer. But one of the themes that was very interesting that I come back to in this trip, because he was really emphasizing the sila, the precepts in Buddhist practice. So the precepts are really virtuous conduct, and in the five precepts are really embodied a sane, civilized way for us to live together in harmony as human beings, as Buddhists, really as a family on the planet. And he saw that in the Western mind that people were very keen on practicing meditation, that they wanted to, you know, get into practicing meditation. But he saw the shortcoming of that the precepts were not really emphasized. And so he wasn't emphasizing, well, you have to have precepts before you can practice meditation, but rather pointing to that there's a balance. And if you find your practice going along and you're having trouble or you're struggling with something, then it's like, well, how am I living my life? And one of the funniest things he said, I remember when we did the retreat at IMS, he says, you people are really funny. He said, you come in here and you blast yourself with 10 days of quiet and meditation, and then you go off for the other 10 months of the year and you blast yourself with sensual indulgence. And then you come back and you blast yourself with another retreat, and there's this constant kind of to-ing and fro-ing. And he says, how can you expect to have a peaceful mind and something that can really sustain you without having a daily practice, without having something that sustains you in every day? And to me, since leaving the monastery, it's really been, I haven't sat every day, I haven't done a lot of retreats, but one of the things I made clear when I left, I sat, felt and trusted and had incredible faith, as long as I kept these five precepts pretty much pure and clear in my life as my kind of guideline, that I would be all right. And there's a lot of times that I didn't think I was all right, but that I've kept as my standard, and I really feel it's been a savior. It's like having lived with the community for 20 years, it's like being on this huge ocean liner. You know, and I kind of imagine one of these cruise ships that they have these days. I mean, they're very modern and have all these kind of luxurious. It's very comfortable. And even though the monastic sangha is not like a luxury liner, but it's like an ocean liner. It's like there's this safety, there's this incredible kind of thing that holds you and that you're a part of. And so leaving that after so long for me was like jumping overboard from the ocean liner and being out to set out to sea all by myself. And my lifesaver that I had that kept me afloat were really the five precepts. And to me, that's a very powerful teaching, a very powerful thing that I have kept, and that this wonderful man that we're celebrating and honoring through this weekend really gave me. And I don't think I could have had that clarity without having invested the time and energy that I did in those years. When I was thinking about this last night when we were kind of planning our offerings and things, I was thinking about all of the things that I would like to say and share. And I says, oh, heck, I can take the weekend for myself. And I'm sure all of us that have lived and trained with Ajahn Chah, that this could be a weekend in itself, just with one person sharing and offering. But the wonderful thing about it is that we're kind of passing the talking stick, as it were, the baton to each other, and having the opportunity to hear from many different people. So in the interest of time, I think we're going to open it up now for comments, questions.